American West occupies an unusual cultural space. It is a historical period, but also a mythological one, a geographical region, but also a symbolic frontier, a real site of labour, settlement, violence and displacement, but also a stage to explore ideas around freedom, masculinity and moral clarity. Through cinema, this space becomes even more ambiguous, a weird kind of netherworld, as many viewers instinctively feel, where fact and fiction intertwine so tightly, then disentangling them seems almost beside the point. This ambiguity becomes especially visible when contrasting how Westerns position themselves in time. A film such as Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch is set in 1913, at the twilight of the frontier, on the verge of modernity, symbolised by the automobile, the machine gun and the Mexican Revolution. Yet for many viewers, 1913 feels too late for the Western. Our internal chronologies insist that the frontier belongs to the deep past, not the era of telegraphs, railroads and early cinema. The actual historical decline of the frontier, codified in 1819 by the US Census Bureau, clashes with the timelessness of the myth. And this conflict between history and mythology is already present at the very beginning of narrative film. Edwin S. Porter's The Great Train Robbery, 1903, one of the foundational works of American cinema, was made at a moment when the real West was not yet fully gone. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, whose exploits the film likely drew upon, were still active. Their departure for South America would not occur until 1904, and their apparent deaths not until 1908. The Great Train Robbery then dramatises outlaw behaviour that its first audiences could have read about as contemporary news. And yet the film does not feel contemporary, neither now nor by accounts then. What it offers instead is a condensation of the West's central themes, violence as a moral instrument, outlaws and posses as archetypes, and the train as a technological symbol of American modernity, and an implicit belief that justice will be enacted by communities rather than institutions. The film therefore occupies a peculiar dual position. It's both the product of its moment, and also is mythologizing that very same moment, a fiction produced in tandem with the history it was drawing upon. I think to appreciate the innovation of The Great Train Robbery, it's important to think about it within the early history of film, because cinema before 1903 was largely non-narrative. They were kind of very brief stage demonstration or fragments of vaudeville performances produced by kinetoscope, and there was things like Buffalo Bill's Wild West Performers, which had like Lakota dancers and cowboy exhibitions frequently appeared in these films. Edison's own Buffalo Dance in 1894, for instance, displays native performers as anthropological spectacle rather than narrative subjects. But the West was already being framed as an object of display. There was a kind of an exotic nature to it, performative. And clearly there was an audience for this. So I don't really think The Great Train Robbery invent the Western on film, nor was it the first fiction film, nor was it the first to use the mise-en-scène of cinema, such as medium shots and various other framing devices, but it unified these elements into a narrative which hadn't really been seen before by American audiences, and it transformed the cinema of attractions into, I think, getting us on the path of where we are today, which is the cinema of telling stories. So I think in this sense, the film represents not merely a kind of a technical achievement, but also a very significant cultural moment, perhaps a recognition that film could do more than just show. It could also tell us engaging narratives. Now, Thomas Edison, for all his controversies surrounding his business practices, really did understand that cinema had huge commercial potential. And the fierce competition among early studios pushed experimentation forward. Porter was tasked with creating a more ambitious narrative than any of the studio's early offerings. And he drew upon contemporary newspaper accounts of train robberies, stage melodramas, and possibly even real-life folklore tales about outlaws. And what emerges is a work that in 14 scenes and roughly about 11 minutes establishes a visual and thematic vocabulary that would really, I think, come to define the Western genre for decades to come. One of Porter's most striking decisions is to align the viewer almost immediately with the outlaws. The opening scene shows him entering a telegraph office, subduing a clerk, and initiating the robbery. We are given no backstory, no moral explanation, and no justification, only actions. The absence of character psychology is significant. These are not individuals, but types, precursors to the black-hatted villains of classical Hollywood westerns. Yet by placing the camera on their side of events, Porter grants them narrative centrality. And this alignment has an important psychological effect. In several scenes, especially when the game lurks behind foreground props as the train approaches, we, the spectators, become accomplices. We know what the unsuspecting passengers do not. And Porter's compositions often position the viewer as if hidden alongside the robbers, watching with this very same predatory suspense. This is a primitive but nonetheless powerful form of cinematic voyeurism. As film academics such as Laura Mulvey would later argue, voyeurism is integral to cinema. The camera invites viewers to occupy positions they would not ethically occupy in reality, and the Great Train Robbery demonstrate that this mechanism was present from cinema's earliest narrative structures. The viewer elicits thrill, anticipating violence, watching deception unfold. It's foundational, I think, to the film's pleasure, and American cinema was not born only out of spectacle, but also of complicity. And the violence in The Great Train Robbery is startling, not only for its era, but even for contemporary viewers familiar with early cinema's supposed decorum. Porter's outlaws are not charming rogues. They are ruthless, impulsive, and unhesitating in their brutality. They shoot an unarmed passenger in the back, bludgeon a crew member with a chunk of coal, and dispatch resistors with clinical efficiency. The violence serves multiple functions. First, it legitimizes the posse's later pursuit, establishing a clear right and wrong that the film must correct. And second, it provides spectacle, moments designed to shock and thrill the audiences. And third, and most importantly, it constructs an aesthetic logic that American film would return to repeatedly: violence as a mean of narrative resolution and engagement. Later westerns such as The Wild Bunch or Unforgiven would interrogate the consequences of violence, exploring psychological damage and moral ambiguity. Even the revisionist westerns of the 60s and 70s with their anti-heroes and ethical murkiness ultimately rely on violence as a mechanism by which narrative tension is resolved. And Porter's film anticipates all of this, but without introspection. Violence is simply part of the film's grammar. In this sense, The Great Train Robbery can be understood as both a classical and revisionist Western. Classical in its clear division between good and evil, and revisionist in its willingness to depict violence with unflinching directness. The train represents one of the most important aspects of Western culture, from computer games such as Red Dead Redemption to the Western itself. It plays a central symbolic role, and by 1903, railroads had long become the backbone of American expansion, associated simultaneously with opportunity and displacement. In Western iconography, trains signify modernity encroaching upon the frontier, the advance of industrial capitalism, and the shrinking of wilderness. Porter stages much of the action on and around the train, using its motion to enhance the film's dynamism. The match cut between interior and exterior shots, simple by modern standards, would have been thrilling for contemporary audiences, offering a persuasive illusion of continuity. Moreover, the train allows Porter to stage violence in a moving landscape, emphasising speed, danger, and technological power. This dynamic staging contrasts with earlier static kinetoscope presentations and prefigures the kinetic energy that defines action cinema. The West, in this formulation, is not a pastoral setting, but a site where modernity collides with the lawlessness of the posse's behaviour. And when the film does shift to the posse, it shifts in tone as well. The saloon scene with dancers and comic gunplay introduces the idea of community, however loosely defined, as a stabilising force opposing outlaw chaos. The posse members are anonymous as the criminals, yet their moral position is unambiguous. They represent collective action in the face of threat, and this collective self-enforcement reflects a recurring motif in Western mythology. The idea that the frontier is too distant or too lawless for formal institutions to establish any kind of order, leaving individual communities to enact justice. It is a mythologized version of American self-reliance, resonant with national narratives about independence and moral duty. Historical reality was far more complex. Law enforcement networks and territorial courts existed, but the myth persists across cinematic and literary traditions, and the Great Train Robbery offers one of the earliest visual articulations of this mythology. Justice is a swift, local, and unencumbered by the due process, and this demands and receives moral closure through gunfire. The film's concluding image, Justice D. Barnes stepping forward, pointing his revolver directly at the camera and firing, remains one of the most recognisable in cinema history. Although exhibitors could place this shot at the beginning or end, porters preferred the conclusion, and the effect is profound. On the one level, the shot symbolises the outlaw's continued threat. Even after the narrative has resolved, danger persists. On another level, it collapses the boundary between viewer and the film, enacting a direct confrontation. The spectator is no longer a distant observer, but an implied target. And the gesture antithesizes the voyeuristic dynamics established throughout the film. Having aligned viewers with the criminals at various points, Porter now turns their complicity against them. It is also a declaration of cinema's power. The screen is not a passive window, but a space from which characters can look back, challenge, and implicate the audience. Scorsese's homage in Goodfellas underscores the shot's enduring cultural influence. The gangster, like the outlaw, stares down the viewer, firing a symbolic reminder that American cinema has always been captivated by charismatic violence. The Great Train Robbery, therefore, is more than a historical curiosity or technical milestone. It's a foundational film in the construction of America's cinematic mythology. Created when the frontier still lingered in cultural memory, it nevertheless presents the West as a timeless myth, populated by archetypal villains, communal heroes, and a landscape shaped by technological change. Its violence, perspective, and narrative simplicity established patterns that would echo across the Western genre and into American cinema more broadly, from gangster films to action thrillers, from noir to revisionist westerns. It demonstrates that the appetite for cinematic violence, narrative clarity, and moral spectacle was present from the very beginning of film. A revisionist western, before revisionism existed, it captures a moment when myth and history overlapped, when the last traces of the real frontier coexisted with the first flickerings of cinematic imagination. It is a brief runtime, 11 minutes, but the Great Train Robbery simultaneously memorialises and mythologises the West, inaugurating a century of stories where fact and fiction blur in the American cultural mind. So that's going to be it for this episode of the 24 Frames cast. I will leave a link to a YouTube version of the film. I've actually got, I've got it on a Kino box set somewhere, but that, to be honest with you, because of the age of the film, there's not really much, a great deal of difference in the quality of it. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I'm going to try and do more films about silent cinema. It's an area of film where I feel like I don't watch enough silent films, and I know it's a bit of a kind of a cliche place to start, and this episode did actually appear in another form on my last incarnation of the 24 Frames cast, and it was kind of quite nice to go back to the script armed with a little bit more knowledge and historical perspective. So I hope you enjoyed it. There will be more to come. If you want to get in contact with me, you can email me at 24framescast@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Thomas24FC. I am now on Blue Sky as well, which is 24framescast79.bssky.social. I will be in contact very soon. Many thanks for listening. Bye.